Hello, welcome to episode 4 of the RTE Rugby Podcast, available on rte.ie, iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can contact us on Twitter at RTE Rugby, Facebook /RTE Sport. So who have we got today? Well, Elaine Buckley from the production team at RTE Sport is here. Wes Liddy is the producer of Against the Head and Michael Glennon of the Online Sports Desk. Later on, we'll talk to former Ireland captain Michael Bradley, now coaching Zebre in Italy, and get his thoughts on Italian rugby ahead of Sunday's game. Alison Donnelly and Elaine will go through the latest from the Women's Six Nations. We'll also hear from Ireland's Catherine Dane and Claire Bowles. Finally, we're going to chat about the Premier League, darts that is, former Glasgow hooker Gerwyn Price currently tearing things up, literally and metaphorically, on the PDC dart circuit, is in town for the darts. We'll talk about his experience of changing from one sport to another and going from being an aggressive hooker to a pumped up Arrowsmith. That's Gerwyn Price to come up. But first of all, Michael, what's causing interest on the website?
Yeah, an interesting one, a very interesting one, actually. As if England didn't have enough snarl or that in their camp, John Terry came in to give the England's Grand Slam chasers a pep talk ahead of the Wales game. And Steve Borthwick summarised it. John Terry spoke about the traits in the highly successful teams he has been part of, consistent with the type of thing we talk about, competitiveness, the drive in training, players taking responsibility, leadership density, the strength.
Yeah, I noticed that phrase, leadership density, is a new one on me. Yeah.
That's John Terry. All the successful teams have had a great group of leaders. That's something we're well aware of and continue to develop. So that was popular on our website. Also, the news that Ian Henderson was cleared to play after being cited for tackle while playing for Ulster, and he got the all clear yesterday, has come back into training. I think he's only played one game this
good timing
one game
for
in advance of the Ospreys game, and very good timing with Ireland's second row injury problems. So that was popular.
Okay, John Terry snarl. Wes, what's your opinion on that? Should it be bottled?
Yeah, it's an interesting choice of motivational speaker. But look, in fairness, the guy captained a successful team and his country a couple of times. So, you know, let's be honest, the odds of making it to that end of professional soccer compared to rugby are enormous. So I think anyone who's high achieved in that field has to be listened to. And probably not a guy who relied on talent in the strictest sense of the word, and more kind of, you know, was some of those battling qualities and things like that. So I'm sure ultra professional, you know, because the temptations, I'd imagine, when you go into the stratosphere of Premiership soccer money, like this, the level of self-motivation these top guys must have to keep on the treadmill must be enormous, you know.
Would Martin Johnson be his equivalent of, would he be the same style leader?
They probably went to slightly different type of secondary schools, I'd say, but yeah, similar enough, I suppose.
Yeah, Johnson, though, I remember reading his book. He's not from the Silver Spoon wing of British society.
No, but
hard-working parents,
yeah,
kind of,
yeah,
hard, you know, a value system instilled in him as a youth and blah, blah, blah. But there's a cultural dissonance. Anything about John Terry and other English people have that, we just don't understand how they could be in any way motivating, because we kind of look at them and go, they stand for a certain breed of Englishness that possibly doesn't translate to us Irish.
Yeah, it's funny, funny choice for the multicultural English rugby team as well, considering some of his track record on that front. So anyway,
John
they're
Terry.
Into it.
What about Ian Henderson, more to the point?
Yeah, great. Surprising he recovered so quickly from injury first, and then I suppose the good fortune or otherwise to escape censure for the after the weekend. But Tadhg Byrne back as well. So, yeah, like two very interesting guys in that, you know, both almost as comfortable playing at six. So, you know, for a World Cup squad ultimately down the line, massive advantages to having those guys available to you.
Well, they are both players that can play big games against the best opposition as well. So, I mean, to have them available.
I think Tadhg Byrne is a much more unproven case than Ian Henderson
in the big games.
Yeah. I mean, I know obviously at club level he's done it, but he's not a massive man. He's about 6'5". He's a little on the light side by modern second-row standards. Whether he can kind of physically you know, if you see the amount of jackling he does at club level, whether he can physically withstand that, the punishment that that entails with that one step up to the elite level of the international game, very much, for me, very much wait and see, you know. But undoubtedly a hugely talented, versatile footballer.
Yeah, we don't know. He doesn't know himself,
I suppose. Playing in the back row in a World Cup quarterfinal against South Africa, that's not playing Treviso and Musgrave Park, you know.
No, you're right. I suppose Henderson has stamped his authority on big games, whereas Byrne has stamped his authority on second tier games.
Yeah, now he's done it against some excellent opposition, with, you know, like when they've played Leinster or whoever the top provincial teams are. But yeah, I mean, I think anyone you ever talk to, whether it's coaches or players, tell you just to step up at an international level in terms of pace and power is still huge, you know.
And out the backs then, we have Chris Farrell, who's come back. He left the Munster match early, maybe 20 minutes, was taken off as a precaution, but he trained fully. And then the return of Robbie Henshaw from a dead leg also gives Joe Schmidt a decision I guess he didn't want to make, or it will dominate a lot of the talk, whether he just tries Robbie Henshaw again or sticks with Rob Kearney. And I suppose, what would you learn against Italy? Is that something...
When is team announced?
Team is announced on Friday afternoon.
Right, so anything from Carton... Oh yeah, we have something with Bundyaki. He was on duty, media duty down at Carton House today. We'll get a word from Bundyaki.
The down week wasn't really a down week. It was a good hard session. We had really good days off in the beginning of the week, and then we came in towards the end of the week and had a good training sessions with the 20s. And it was very good. It was nice to keep the feet up, spend time with a bit of family and refresh your mind a bit. So, yeah, very good.
You've played with so many centre partnerships. I think Tom Farrell is probably the one that's left in the squad that you haven't played for Ireland with. I mean, what's happened to him, like, in the squad? What sort of character is he?
Tom's just putting his head down and doing what he's told. You know, he's working really well. He's training really hard. He's doing exactly what he does at Connacht, their training, and he's just, I'm sure, when Tom gets the opportunity to put on that green jersey, I'm sure he'll perform just as well as he does at Connacht.
Okay, Mick, what you make of that?
Yeah, so that's Bundyaki, who has, you know, he, for all the talk of injuries and all the guys inside and outside him who have got injured, he's kind of been a consistent player. He's had so many partners in there. He appears now to be a Joe Schmidt favourite, and you could see that Joe was shuffling the deck to fit Bundyaki in, because everyone thought that if Ringrose and Henshaw are fit, they would just go into the centre. And it was this decision that was always being put off because one or the other would be unavailable through injury. So Aki is a favourite son in there, certainly.
How is the impact sub philosophy? How does that translate to midfield? I mean, we know it works for back row and it works for other positions.
Well, you're generally going to have a scrum half and an out half, a specialist. So whoever your third sub is going to notionally cover beyond the midfield to the back three. So in some ways it doesn't impact. And I think Joe has been quite functional in how he selected his bench a lot of times in the past, in that he's actually looked to box off as many positions covered in the equation as possible, rather than say, I've got one 13 who can make a huge impact on a game, but he can only play one position. He'll generally go with the guy who can play a couple of positions, albeit not quite so well. And he's often used, his out halves have often covered 15, you know, if you look at Ian Madigan, obviously Joey Carberry now as well. So I don't think I see whoever loses out in midfield being the 23rd man.
It's hard to get a kind of a firm fix on this game, isn't it? It really is almost, we're projecting into the future. Get it over, get a win, and then see how we approach the last two. Both in terms of team selection and in terms of how it pans out in the narrative of the World Cup.
Well, I suppose, though, if it was, you know, everyone seemed to reach a consensus that it was a nervy kind of day out against Scotland. So I think to have the 2 weeks, 1 week where you're largely at home, to just go away, forget about it, you know, recalibrate, whatever they like to call it. Maybe it just took the sting out of it, or like let him finally put the kind of poorish performance the first day to bed. And because it's not necessarily the most daunting fixture, maybe there's an opportunity to kind of go out and get some confidence back with a kind of re-energised performance, because they did look a little bit, I don't know, they were a slight bit lethargic by their usual standards, it seemed, in both of the first two games. You know, just the same energy, just that sense of energy wasn't there, even in terms of people's body language, you know.
Yeah, and that kind of sense of control. I mean, it was just such a machine to watch there for six or eight games that they looked at the right period of time to be controlling the cadence of the match and, you know, knowing what to do at the right time.
Yeah, well, they almost seemed kind of reactive or unreactive to what was happening in front of them, and that they kind of persisted playing the same way in spite of maybe the evidence in front of their face. But whether that's you know, an attempt at evolving to some other place in terms of game plan, possibly. But yeah, no, I mean, you'd have to be still pretty positive going into this weekend, you know?
Look, it's ridiculous not to be. 95% of the last 2 or 3 years has been just brought us onto a new sphere altogether. But look, that's the way it is, isn't it? Now, all of a sudden, a couple of what we perceive as substandard, easy for us to say, performances. The only thing is, if Italy were any good, you'd be worried. You'd have a snaky feeling. Italy at home, Ireland kind of a little bit nervous, as you said. But there doesn't seem to be any realistic chance of getting capsized.
I know there's all these good vibes about Zebre and Treviso and the under-20s form and kind of this, you know, that there's this narrative that there's a huge amount improving with the structures over there. But like when Italy were actually at their strongest in terms of results was probably prior to them entering the
Six Nations.
Then Five Nations.
Yeah.
And if you look at that, like the kind of backbone of that team, that Alessandro Troncon, Christian Stoica, Paolo Vaccari, Massimo Cutito, all those guys, like one, a lot of them were Argentinian.
Yeah.
But two, there was a sense that there was a kind of covert professionalism in clubs in Italy throughout the 90s, like Campesi and Lina and guys like that all played over there. So bizarrely, maybe they were better equipped or more professionally equipped before they were actually, you know, admitted into the professional circle, so to speak.
Yeah, but you can't freeze time, can you?
No, you can't. But the form that gathered them their place in the Six Nations, you know, has almost been an anomaly when you look back at it. They've never really hit that form again. I remember them beating us in Lansdowne Road by 20 points in 1999.
What's the media access like, been like the last, since Ireland's invincibility has been threatened?
Well, didn't send so many guys out after the England match, and that's, I suppose, natural. There probably wasn't even room in the mix zone for the amount of English lads that came out to do interviews and were doing off-the-cuff interviews that weren't pre-arranged with all the media outlets. And after the Scotland match, everyone obviously in a better humour, and we spoke to Quinn Roo and Ulton Delan, who obviously don't get an opportunity to play a Six Nations game, so we spoke to them. Joey Carberry came out and was hounded for 10 or 15 minutes. So yeah, no, the access is fine. I was just wondering whether it's something Johnny Holland referred to in the column on the RTÉ website, and Gordon Darcy was mentioning as well, that now that the pressure's off, nobody realistically is thinking that Ireland can retain their championship. It takes a couple of freak results. It's not just result that they're looking on. And will that feed into a team? Is there less pressure? If you're not playing a must-win game, does that translate into playing more heads-up rugby, playing a little bit more off the cuff? And maybe it's something, it's hard to see it, because against Italy, which things can happen
anyway. I don't know, I have a problem with that theory, because I don't think Joe sees kind of empirical benefits in unstructured rugby, in expressing yourself. I could be all wrong here. I mean, he will use the 80 minutes as part of a process. And that's what's got us where it is. Whether or not we want to be Harlem Globetrotterized isn't...
Too late to jump ship now.
Absolutely. We're stuck in now, aren't we? All right, lads. Thanks. OK, we have Elaine Buckley here, and Scrum Queen's Alison Donnelly is on the line. But first, let's hear from the Ireland camp. Damien O'Mara caught up with Claire Bowles ahead of Saturday's clash with Italy in Parma. Claire Bowles made her debut against Scotland, you might remember, and had been on sevens duty in Australia. Damien started by asking her about the switch between the codes.
There's a bit of a switch that you have to, like, if you're going to sevens training, you're obviously focusing on different kind of things, like, whereas in 15s, it's... training's a wee bit different, if you know what I mean. So there's definitely different focuses.
How much has the Australian experience stood to you in terms of experiencing a different culture, experiencing maybe what some people might consider a higher level of sevens rugby, to bring that back in, to feed into your own game and the game of teammates around you?
Yeah, no, it was a great experience, and it was so good to get such a good amount of game time playing with different girls that we hadn't played with before. So it's good to get used to girls playing different styles, and sometimes you just have to be thrown in there and play your ball.
And how, I presume there's a culture over here that they try and tap you for as much information as they can, or there's a way for you to feed what you've learned back into the Irish setup, because ultimately that's how everyone improves, is by expanding
helping
the net.
Each other. Yeah, no, definitely. When we came back, like, we built a lot in our skills and stuff, so when we came back here, we obviously went to train and tried to show everyone like what we'd learnt and put up to the test, really.
Right, Alison is on the line. How was your week, Alison, thus far?
It's been good, but the highlight, of course, is talking to you guys.
Oh, listen, you're such a smoothie. You work in PR, though, don't you?
That is true, yes.
Yeah. Or what's it called these days? Has it rebranded itself?
We're communications specialists now.
Yeah, I believe you. Elaine, the team is out, which helps us on a Wednesday.
Yeah, a team came out at lunchtime, and there's, I suppose, the big change to talk about is Catherine Dane is in for scrum half, in at scrum half for Ailsa Hughes. So Alison, what do you think about that? How's that going to mix up the Irish team this weekend?
Well, I can't say I've seen too much of Catherine, so I don't know what she will bring to it. But I did think perhaps they did need a change there. I thought Ailsa did very well, but there are times she tended to slow the ball down away from the breakdown. And, you know, she's a great, fast, speedy sort of breaking type of scrum half, but maybe Ireland just looking for something slightly different against a pretty experienced, I mean, we haven't seen the Italian starting team yet, but a very experienced 9 and 10 most likely there, and a quite kind of wily back row as well. So perhaps they're just looking to slightly mix it up there. So I think that's an interesting change. And, you know, it depending on the type of play that Catherine can bring might help Ireland in an area they maybe had some issues with.
Yeah, I think maybe with the last time out, because they got the fourth try, because they got the bonus point, you know, it added kind of obviously extra gloss to the win, but there were an awful lot of missed opportunities, a lot of which came from handling errors. So I suppose that's kind of what's being targeted here.
It's true. And, you know, I mean, I think the positive for Ireland last weekend is they got a bonus point against a team they lost to last year, right? So lots to be positive about in terms of the actual result and getting, you know, all of the points that were available. Italy, a different challenge this weekend, but actually it's quite a good game to come on the back of the Scotland win. They know they can go there and win. So, you know, they weren't clinical very much against Scotland, but actually if you watch the Italy-Wales game, which of course ended with a 3-3 draw, they weren't clinical either. So you've got two teams actually, you know, who lacked in a certain area last week looking to put things right. So I think this is actually the interesting game of the weekend, because the other results I think are pretty set in stone. We believe England and France will win their two games. This game, I think, is the one where you don't really know what's going to come, and you've got two teams who need to sharpen up.
And Italy are, of course, unbeaten to date and have home advantage, but this is effectively a battle for third place in the championship.
Absolutely. I mean, Italy unbeaten is a slightly misleading. They had two easier games than Ireland, and that's just true. You know, they played Scotland and Wales, teams that they would now expect to beat. So, yes, they're unbeaten. They won't stay unbeaten. I can't see them beating England or France. But you know, they're a good team. They are a team who have been... I would say they're the most improved team in Europe, actually, over the last sort of year or so. And they'll be, you know, very confident at home. They know they can beat Ireland, so... this is actually, you're right, a game for third. Italy maybe actually start as slight favourites.
So the big hit women to look out for in the Italian lineup.
Yeah, I mean, they've got real experienced backs, you know, Rigoni in the centre, Solari as well, Forlani at full-back, really good players. I mean, the one I'm excited about and I keep writing about is Giada Franco on the flank. Italy have always lacked a really strong, powerful strike runner in their background. Now they've got one. I mean, she's been one of the players of the championship, actually. I mean, she is a bit obvious. She's a sort of Billy Vonopola type of runner. You know, you can see her coming a mile away, but that doesn't mean you can stop her. So she's really interesting. She's got good feet, you know, still finding her sort of experience at this level. So those are the sort of names we should be watching out for.
Some other interesting, I suppose, additions to the Ireland bench. Lindsay Peat back from injury, Laura Sheehan making her first squad appearance since a very impressive run out against USA in the November internationals, and also Dervla Nikavard back post Sydney Sevens. So impact from the bench could be a big factor for Ireland as well.
Definitely, and you'd have to say those are all positive additions, and that's no disrespect to the players they're replacing. I think Lindsay in particular, you know, she is such a brilliant impact sub to be able to bring on. You know what you're going to get with her, all power running, you know, never giving up, sort of there or thereabouts a few metres from the try line, very hard to stop. So I think, you know, when Ireland see her coming on later in the game, that's going to give everyone a bit of a boost, actually. So really interesting to see how they play their bench.
And looking to the other games of the weekend, France are going to be heading out on somewhat of a redemption mission against Scotland.
Yeah, I feel for Scotland. It was always going to be hard to go there and you know, perform and do well. And now they've got a French team who are obviously kicking themselves about how, frankly, badly they played against England. I mean, England did not let them play well, that's for sure, in the first hour of the match. But, you know, France made a litany of mistakes and, you know, some of the things that they did badly, you know, weren't because of pressure. They just played very poorly. Many things were pressure, of course. So I do feel for Scotland. I can't see them going there and picking much up, but they'll just be looking for a performance and frankly, to get out of there as unscathed as possible.
Yeah, Alison, two quick ones for you. England have the luxury now of using this, using the remaining games as early test material for 2021, I guess.
Definitely. And I think, you know, it's easy to forget that we're 2.5 years away from Women's World Cup. This is the time when coaches will be looking to build depth in their squad and looking around. And I suppose England can scarcely believe that they're into the third round, and they will never say this, but really the title is now theirs to lose. And so he does have the luxury, Simon Middleton, of being able to bring some new players in. I mean, he may not want to do that. He may respect the championship a bit too much for that. But certainly if you're going to do that any time, you know, you've beaten France already, you've beaten Ireland, the rest of the games you should win. Now is the time he can take some chances, and interesting to see if he does do that.
Nice position, yeah. And the final one before I let you go, Alison, I mean, you referred to Italian women's rugby as most improved there, and I think it's true under the surface. And we were chatting to Michael Bradley, just across Italian rugby, the men's clubs and the 20s men and the women, it hasn't manifested itself possibly yet in the senior men. But what are the structural changes? Anything we can learn from there? Because it does seem to have the bit between its teeth about getting its approach right.
Actually, I think this Italian women's team is not dissimilar from the Irish women's team back in 2013-14. What they've got is a core of very experienced players who've, you know, been there for some time and have learned how to play at this level and then added to it with youth. And so if you look back at Irish teams 4 or 5 years ago, the seed of the team who went on to win titles, that was sort of a similar thing. And because underneath the surface initially, there aren't huge playing numbers and there isn't great depth. And that was the same in Ireland. So there are actually quite a lot of similarities. They play a similar type structure, club games, regional competitions and so on. And they're, you know, their core player base isn't large. You know, it's in and around where we are. So actually, there isn't like a whole sort of strategy there that we can learn from them. What they're doing is similar to us. And actually, that's what makes them quite interesting, I think. They are making the best out of the resources that they have.
And thanks to Alison Donnelly of scrumqueens.com. We'll chat to her next week. Now, just to finish up on the women's rugby, let's also hear from Catherine Dane, Ireland's new scrum half. She was chatting with Damien.
It's going to be a fairly formidable challenge, isn't it? Because it seems not quite maybe to be a new look Italian team, but it's certainly a more formidable Italian outfit than perhaps we've seen in recent championships.
Absolutely, yeah. They seem to be very threatening, and they have that offload option that can really break down any defensive lines. Notorious for their turnovers and things, and counter attack, that will be a bit of pressure for us. But
so, is there a lot of focus then, or maybe an increased focus this week on the defensive aspect of the Ireland game, or do you just focus more on what you can do yourselves and trying to impose the Irish game and make life as difficult for them before they can make it difficult for you?
Absolutely, yeah. We do look at their strengths and our strengths, and we try to shut down their strengths as best we can, but the main focus is playing our game.
Okay, well, to get some Italian perspective, let's go over to Parma and join Michael Bradley, who's the Zebre coach, and hear what Michael makes of the weekend ahead and indeed his long life in rugby. We'll recap on some of his pit stops during what it must be now a 20-year-old coaching career. Afternoon, Michael.
Sarah, how are you?
just looking at it, Michael, where do we start with you? I mean, Zebre at the moment, but like just in general, I mean, we look back at Edinburgh, Connacht, Georgia, Romania. Gosh, you've been travelling, haven't you, for the last... A life in rugby isn't glamour, especially when you're going to teams that, you know, need to be kind of picked up every Monday morning or every second Monday morning at least.
Yeah, I mean, in that rotation, I mean, there were some very good times in all of those
huge
teams
highs,
as well,
huge there, highs. Know? I get that Edinburgh semi-final, Heineken Cup, and all the rest of it, Jan. But at the same time, yeah, I suppose it's tough work when you're constantly associated with teams who, through nothing to do with you, really, are teams that if they're not struggling, they're not winning the majority of their games.
Well, ironically, in that list, Georgia won four Grand Slams in a row, so they're a very successful team. So you have, you have that element there as well. So I don't know. I mean, the job is the job from my point of view. I mean, you go in and you assess what you have, and then you try and get the best out of the lad, you know.
But you must really love it, Michael.
I enjoy working in rugby, yes, and I enjoy coaching, you know, and when I go to any organisation, obviously my objective is to leave it in a better place than it was when I arrived, if I can, and along the way try and improve the players as best I can with whatever staff is there, if we bring people in, so it's an interesting challenge all the time.
And throughout the most interesting period in rugby's development as well. I mean, looking back, what year did you go to Connacht? It must be 15 years ago, is it?
I went to Connacht. That's a good question. 2003, I'd say. Yeah, that year. Yeah. And so I was in Connacht 7 years.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. And you had that mad run in the Shields or whatever it was called. Was it 04? And that was the first inkling.
Connacht is a roller coaster ride certainly in those days. Now it's a formidable force, which is fantastic. I mean, that's the beauty of Connacht nowadays, you know. And with the new development coming online, it's really a great credit to everybody who's up there at the moment.
But there was a time where, and this is, I know you won't praise yourself, and I am standing in admiration here. There was a time where you had to hang in there because, as you say, Connacht is a force to be reckoned with now. It has silverware, it has a very clear identity, it has a lot of hold on people's hearts, both in Connacht and around the place. But it was not always thus.
No, it wasn't. But I suppose on the identity side, which is an interesting point, Dara, you bring up. I mean, I think that was always strong with the locality and then the diaspora out of Connacht. You know, I mean, everybody would have looked to do their best for Connacht, even though when it most needed help and support, it certainly got it. The entity that is Connacht Rugby now, and. And the RFU, in fairness to them, made the decision to run with a rugby equation instead of a financial equation, and they're reaping the rewards ever since, really. And that was a very good decision. Back in, I think, 2007, 2008, there was the turning point in that. There was a lot of hard work for guys like Gerry Kelly and Gerry's crew that were in there at the time, and I mean. That man should be sainted, you know, and for what he did for Connacht Rugby. And, you know, he's obviously he enjoys going to the matches now, as do many other people who were involved at that time. And I think a lot of people have a lot of pride in terms of where Connacht are now, and they're happy to see the success.
Yeah, and from a personal point of view, there's something about the sports ground that just is lacking even in the modern Thomond or certainly the Aviva. I hope it doesn't lose it during the redevelopment. But there is, I don't know, it's more of a tribal is a bad word in modern discourse, but there is a feel that you're kind of shoulder to shoulder with fellas. There's the steam rising off. There's, you know, kids and everyone wandering around the place. And it's kind of got that mad West of Ireland festival feel for a couple of hours, which plugs us into something, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's quite earthy, I suppose. It would be a good description of it, you know. But the fans up there are fantastic. I mean, I remember the good old days or the bad old days when there was 600, 700 people at the sports ground, and we used to play on a Saturday afternoon when everybody else was enjoying themselves down Quay Street and Shop Street. You know, but those supporters, I suppose, are the are the bedrock of the guys who are still coming to the sports ground now. And the season tickets are, I don't know, 3,500, 4,000, which that will have to grow because of the pressure of the new
build
facility coming online. But that's all good pressure, you know. That's fantastic pressure to be under. So and I mean, as I said, look, Connacht is even for Zebra today. Connacht is a blueprint in terms of the way forward for this club here in Parma.
And, you know, we talk about maybe the life living over there, because I know it has great compensations in terms of, like, you can ski at Christmas on your break and all the rest of it, which is the nice side of it. Zebre, performance in the league is mixed, as we know that. You're struggling for wins. But, like, there's no point in focusing in on that. What there is a point possibly in focusing in on is, I keep hearing, whether it's to do with the 20s or the women, are Treviso obviously being a better example in terms of points on the board, that there's a lot shifting in Italian rugby for the better, not manifested itself yet in the senior game. Give us a feel that under Conor O'Shea and Steve Abboud, I mean, what how deep has this been, this kind of reboot been?
Well, I think those two, I mean, obviously Conor's head is on the block probably more than Steve, in the sense that Steve works in a less visible place, but does fantastic work, and he's great knowledge. He's, you know, 20 years with the IRFU, so, and he knows that, you know, how to build systems to produce good rugby players at a young age to give options to the franchises, you know, and he's doing that now. 3 years, I think it is, already in Italy with Conor. And as I said, Conor's face is on the board at the moment, and you know, it's difficult for him, but the movement has been very positive, and it's about patience, and it's about realizing the talent that is in this country and getting it to Six Nations level as quickly as possible through the system. There's a bit of politicking to be done, I suppose, to smooth that out, but that's not unusual when a country's in a period of growth, you know.
And is there a system that players must play a year or a season with clubs before they're considered for regional, say, representation?
That's part of it, but I mean, like, you know, like Ireland is in an envious position at the moment where the systems are right, the people who made the decisions back along, and then we're going back 15, 20 years, and at that stage the likes of the Conns and the Shannons and the Lansdownes and the Belfast Harlequins, for the want of an example, wanted to run professional rugby in Ireland, and the IRFU took the responsibility on and gave good leadership, and you know, the product that's being produced at the moment is fantastic from an Irish rugby point of view. Now, Italy, as far as, you know, the point you're making there, Italy has the opportunity to change that, because that's the way things are being done at the moment. And when Italy streamlines its pathway to the Six Nations, then you'll see, I think, a progressive improvement in the results, and it'll be a positive environment, a more positive environment to play rugby in. And Treviso and Zebra will benefit from that as well. So, you know, that's the direction that Conor's taking everything over here, and it's not easy, but he's doing a fantastic job at the moment.
Sure, we want it all yesterday, you know.
Michael Glennon here.
I know. Mike, how are you doing?
Not so bad. I'm just wondering, within Italy and within the people you're dealing with, and is there a universal understanding that Conor is making progress, or that all this groundwork and grassroots work has to be done? Or is there any sense that there's patience wearing thin when you look at the Six Nations record, even going back to before his time?
You know, it depends on who you talk to, Michael. I mean, like, you have those who know and work within the rugby circles, and there's no question but the direction is the correct direction, and the work has been done and the foundations are in place, and it is ready to move forward. But I go back to the Irish system 15, 20 years ago, like one or two decisions have to be made and then everything will fall into line, and until they're made, it will stay as it is.
What are those? I know it's politicking and it's probably hard to explain, but what's the key decision there without upsetting any vested interests in the game? What's the key one that you'd change if you had the power?
I think the reality of professional sports is it's high performance driven, and you have to accept that, and then you have to come up with your solution for high performance, and then you have to strive to achieve that. And that to me is the key decision that needs to be made. But it's not immediate. Like as you said, there like we'd want it tomorrow or today or yesterday if possible. It takes time, and as long as time is given, Conor will achieve it.
Wes Liddy's here. Wes is the executive producer of Against the Head, which you know, and he's just going to. We were just actually talking about Italy in the 90s and how competitive they were. Different era, I know. But Wes, do you want to have a?
Yeah, hi, Mike. I was just wondering in terms of the player pathway for young players. I mean, how formalised is it? We're kind of getting a sense maybe that these guys are almost not engaged to, let's say, the extent they are here almost until they make it into a professional environment. Is it kind of at that development level that the majority of work you refer to needs to be done?
No, that work has been done. I mean, it's probably easy and wrong to talk about results, but the Italian under 20 sides, the Italian under 18 sides have been more successful year on year in the last 3 or 4 years, thankfully, due to the work that Stevie has done. And the player numbers that are playing the game underage, we'll say up to under 18, under 19, are very positive. But from a high performance point of view, the connection still has to be more streamlined from, say, post under 20 or under 18. Through the franchises back to the 20s and then back out into the international side of things. If you look at the system that Munster, Leinster, Ulster and Connacht have now at the moment, where they're streamlining players from under 15s, under 16s, they're putting into camps, 17s, 18s, performing internationally at 18s, 20s, and they're already embedded into the academies. So, and have played matches at pro at Pro 14 level at under 20. I mean, we played a Leinster side here last week, and you had 9 of the starting 15 players that played for Leinster played under 20s 2 and 3 years ago, which is fantastic, you know. And then you have another 5 Leinster players playing in Ulster, Munster, and Connacht. So, I mean, what Leinster are doing, if you could bottle it and put it over into any country, it would be a very positive environment to work in.
And in terms of, like you mentioned, the playing numbers growing, and obviously, like, people don't realise the actual size of the country sometimes, but in terms of the kind of baseline athletic ability on offer, are the raw, away from numbers, but in terms of, you know, just the quality of athlete that's out there or not, I mean, is there serious potential there to be harnessed?
Absolutely. Yeah, even in Zebre, and like we're not knocking over wins very regularly, but we have some fantastic athletes training with us, playing with us. Very, very, very talented rugby players. Matteo Menotti, for argument's sake, who signed for Wasps, just announced this week from Zebre. But I mean, the year before he was just out of under 20s, and that year. He got capped for Italy, which was last year, and he was in nominated as one of the players of the tournament. So you have players coming through if we can get them through with that talent, and there are a number of those, and he's a special talent, but there are a number of those that are available and coming through in the system, which is great to see.
Michael, just, you know, knowing you, I saw you as a schoolboy when I was a younger schoolboy, and you were a great sportsman. I know that you could turn your hand to most things and you're a handy golfer. You're big into Cork GA and everything. But just from a personal point of view, and this isn't like meant to be psychoanalyzing anyone, but I'm just wondering, before you finish in rugby, would it not be nice to have a team that wins 70 or 80% of its games, to get a job that you'd actually go into a winning organisation and see what you could do there to prove to yourself? I mean, it's just something you haven't had the chance to do. I know you'd made the point about Georgia, but that's within a different kind of bubble, I suppose, to the one we live in. Is that a fair question to ask you that or not?
It's a fair question, yeah. No problem if Claremont want to ring me tomorrow and invite me over to be head coach. I have no difficulty at all in saying yes. So, I mean, you just, from a coach point of view, you work away, you work to your own principles and values. And, you know, if a job opportunity comes up and either they like you or you like them and there's an agreement, then you move off, you know. I mean, like you did mention Georgia, but I wouldn't kind of dismiss it in a fleeting moment, shall we say. Georgia is a very interesting country now, and it's challenging Italy, shall we say. And at that period, when I was over there, and they're still winning Grand Slams at ENC 2 level.
They gave the All Blacks a fair game too, didn't they, in the World Cup?
In the World Cup, yeah. They did, yeah. But ironically enough, Georgia, that was not Georgia's first team. It was Georgia's second team, because the following 4 days later, I was involved in those matches. We had to play in Namibia, and we just beat them by a point in Sandy Park, down in where Exeter play. So, you know, it's nice to get the Claremont and the Leinsters of this world, but there's only, you know, there's like five clubs like that in Europe, shall we say. I mean, I mean, you mentioned Edinburgh getting to the semi-finals and Connacht getting to the semi-finals back in their day. I mean, for us here now in Zebre, we would like to get to the playoffs and like to get to the semi-final, and if we can get to a final of the Challenge Cup, would be our level at the moment.
Right.
If we can get that right, then that would be a fantastic achievement. You know, it's not. I mean, I was, ironically, we were talking today after I was talking to Leo Cullen, who's just won two European Cups back to back. He as a player has won three or four of them himself. He's captain two different clubs to it, and he's won a couple of Pro 14s. You know, so I mean, there's a guy who's a success story. So you know, if the opportunity comes, Dara, you give me a ring, and between us, we'll do a deal with whoever it is.
I got to get straight on to a hedge fund and get them to buy out Zebre and give you billions to take over the world, Michael.
We don't need billions. We're okay.
Brilliant. Listen, thanks for taking the time, and I think you've Ulster next, is that right? And best of luck in that game.
No, yes, Ulster above. Yeah. We've Ulster above. Yeah, we do. We're looking forward to a trip up to Ulster, and we're playing them on Saturday. Yeah.
Bit of a change of tack now. We're going to bring you something that is, well, there can't be too many stories about darts in a rugby podcast, but we're going to step up to the hockey, and we're going to be joined by the world number 7 darts player. Welcome to Ireland and the RTE Rugby podcast, Gerwyn Price. You're here for the Premier League darts, but you've also played professional rugby and represented Wales right up to under 21 level.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was under 21s. I played most of the age groups coming through. I was like 17s, 18s. I missed out on the FIRA and the 19s, but then I played the under 21s, and so it was a pretty decent start, but unfortunately never really had the full cap. Well, to be honest with you, I played for Glasgow on the off chance of when the Six Nations was on, and I was happy for cover, but I never really played professionally all the time. I played semi-professional for Nice most of my time, so I never really had a regional contract, which I thought I was hard done by in my career, to be honest with you. But I just never really had that opportunity to play on the big stage, to get a chance to play for my country. And I don't understand why that was. I had a little injury with my wrist, which some teams thought were a risk factor. But professional.
And a lot of people here would look back, probably not so much these days, but back in the 70s or 80s or 90s, they'd say that there were a lot of great players who didn't get a cap because their personality didn't fit. Was there? I'm not trying to paint you in this pantomime stuff.
No, everybody was obviously young and dumb, and I used to like to go out and have fun when I was younger, so I really didn't do myself any favours as well. I was young. I used to go out and I used to party and stuff. So if I was as committed then as what I am now, I think I probably would have gone a bit further as well. So part and parcel is probably my own fault a little bit as well. But there we go. You live and learn, don't you?
You do, and I guess the world is full of people in pubs, ex-rugby players saying it should have been me, but at least you got off your behind and found a new focus, and it's worked out pretty well. World number 7, congratulations.
Yeah, it's gone all right so far, touch wood, but you know, anything can change. I didn't think in a million years, 5 years ago, I'd be doing what I'm doing now, but you know, I'm grasping every opportunity, and it seems to be going well, so yeah, just keep practicing well and performing well, hopefully be at the top for a couple more years.
Yeah, because I'm laughing. I'd imagine that the boot money playing for Neath was a couple of hundred notes, and here you are fined over 20 grand, and I know it's...
exactly. That's probably just under my full earnings for the year with Neath Rugby, but you know, it's just something I've got to try and deal with at the moment. I find so I'd rather not really comment about that, to be honest with you, but you know, it's a lot of money, and hopefully something will change and I don't have to pay all that.
Yeah, I mean, that came around like it's a YouTube kind of thing, but you know, these days anyway, it doesn't matter, like everything can be blown out of proportion. But in your own opinion, and then we'll box that off, what did you breach etiquette, or what is darts etiquette for people here who are rugby listeners, I suppose, and don't know? Because just looking at it, you came close to the other player, Gary Anderson, but like I was expecting there'd be digs to be thrown, but when I looked at the YouTube thing, it was far from that.
Yeah, exactly. What you see is exactly what happened, and there was nothing else. Every single game that I play, I celebrate and I show emotions. And you know, it's not as if it's all happened in this one game. It's been a part of my game since day one. Unfortunately, I've started to win and started to play a lot better, and I'm pipping the top boys, and they don't like it. They're some of the toys under the plan, but I'm just going to keep doing what I do. Like you seen on YouTube, yeah, I over celebrate at times sometimes, but that's just my game, and without it, I don't play as well. So, I don't know, it's just something and nothing. And you know, if it was rules in the game beforehand where I'm not allowed to celebrate a certain way, or not allowed to do anything, then I wouldn't do it. But there was no rules, I was never told anything. No, I just went out and played my own game, and now I've got punished for it.
Sure, but look, I mean, you're clever enough to know it's part and parcel of it too, because the controversy sells the game, and the game being sold leads to you being, you know, well paid.
Yeah, but the thing is as well that people like the PDC and everyone, they want you to go on stage, they want you to entertain, they want you to go out there and have fun, but the moment you go and do it, then you get fined for it. So, like, I've seen the Phil Taylor interview, and you know, you just knocked the nail on the head, and that's exactly what I just said. They tell you to do one thing, but then you punish you for it. So I just don't know. I didn't know where to stand at the beginning of the year after the fine had come out, but just gone back to being myself. And if that's over the top, they'll just have to deal with it whichever way they come in.
Look what Garwin, come on. You can't be moaning about it. You're having a great life at the moment. You must be enjoying it.
No, I'm thoroughly enjoying it. Like you said, it's good money. I'm up on stage enjoying myself, and I'm just going to be myself from now on. If people don't like it, then they have to deal with it the best they can. But I'm just going to be myself from now on and just go out and enjoy myself. And if that's too much and they have to ban me or do whatever they're going to have to do, then so be it. But I'm just going to go out and be myself.
Gerwin Michael here.
How are you?
Good. I know in the aftermath of the Grand Slam, and you said that you were pinching money from the professionals' pockets and they don't like it. Do you still see yourself as an outsider?
Well, I was playing rugby 4 or 5 years ago and watching these boys play every year, and I used to love the darts, and I'd watch the Premier League every year. And for me to go up there to be playing with them now, I always class myself as the underdog. But over the last couple of months, I've started to play a lot better and started to believe in myself. So I know I'm good enough to live with them and play with them. But at the end of the day, they've been doing it for years and years and years, and I'm still learning.
Tell me about the moment that you decided to knock rugby on the head or fully focus on darts. How did you come to that decision?
I spoke to a mate of mine who was playing darts. His name's Barry Bates, and he was like saying, come on, come to Pew School, which is qualifying school to train the professional game card. And I was always playing rugby, never really had time. And I said, nah, I don't want to do it. But twisted my arm that much for 1 year, I just said, yeah, go on. You know, the second day in the team round, I got my tour card. Did the circuit for a year and thought, I'm not too bad at this. And in the second year, I started to improve. Started doing a lot of money. And Nice they had a bit of problems off the field, and the club was in a good place. And it was just one option for me, really, is just to jack the rugby. And I was earning decent money and give it 100% in the darts. And I think that was around about 2015, 16, I think.
Very good. Last week, you were playing Raymond up in Glasgow. It was something like a perfect storm. He's probably the most popular guy in the Premier League. You were up in Gary Anderson's home country. What sort of a reception are you expecting tomorrow? It's in Dublin, and I was kind of thinking to myself, against James Wade, the crowd won't know who to boo.
Yeah, but, you know, I get the same wherever I go, though, so I just say I'll expect them to boo, and if it doesn't happen, then I'm happy. But, you know, I'm just expecting now wherever I go, and thing is, if I play well and then two or three legs into the game, the crowd really just go quiet. So I just need to concentrate on my game, play well, and then don't worry about the crowd.
Yeah, because I like it. The fact that most things in life you have to lick up to your market or your audience, but you kind of take them on. If they start booing you and you hit a 180, you turn around and say, come on now, or whatever, and you feed off that. That's what I enjoy, because you're not trying to be loved universally, which is a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, but that's the thing is, every time I hit a 180 on a good shot out, and, you know, and I give it large and it gets my adrenaline going, but that seems to be the problem. But I don't know, it's just crazy. I'm going to just keep doing what I do. I enjoy hitting the 180s and hitting big scores, playing in front of huge crowds. And tomorrow in Ireland, if it's going to be booze, I'm just going to lap it up like I did in Glasgow and just enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny to say it's not personal, but it almost isn't. Tell me a bit about the mental game, the crossover from rugby. Because when I watch you, it seems to be that, like, when it gets to a tight match and, you know, you're on the doubles and you're on the kind of, you've six or seven darts per player, and one missed dart can twist the match in your opponent's direction. It is a hugely mental game. And you come across as if you don't have a fear in the world. Is that a bit of an act, or do you find that actually representing yourself as a macho, fearless guy translates into the action when you throw?
No, it's hard to explain. Is when you're on the stage and you're in the moment, you just try to do the best you can. And sometimes the doubles are going first half, second half, and other times you can't hit the band over the shot. I don't know. I might look calm, composed, and full of confidence on the stage, but underneath, it's going like a banner out. But I don't know. They've been doing it all for the last 10, 15 years, like Sabani and Gary Anderson. They're all used to it. Like I said, I'm still learning. I'm going to get better. And the last weekend, I played outstanding darts and lost in a semi-final, but I think over the next 2 or 3 years, I'm just going to get a lot better player.
Final question. Wales, England, what do you make of it?
I think it's going to be really tough for Wales. I think England will probably tip us. As much as I hate to say that, England are playing brilliant. I hope Wales go out and beat them, but I think it's going to be a tight game. England maybe, I don't know, win by 5 points, 20 points to 15, something like that.
Great. Well, listen, enjoy Dublin, enjoy Ireland. Good to have you over here, and thanks for joining us this afternoon, Gerwin. All the best.
That's okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, that's it for this episode. Don't forget we're available on RTE.ie, iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Production-wise, thanks to Ronan Lawler, who produced, and Ruth Kennington, who was in sound. And thanks to Elaine, Michael, Wes and Alison for dropping in here. Don't forget upcoming rugby on RTE, Women's Six Nations, Italy-Ireland Live, That's from 6:30 on RTE2 and Radio 1 Extra on Saturday. Live national radio commentary of Italy-Ireland on 2FM. That's the game on Sunday, obviously. And don't forget to catch up with all the weekend's action on next Monday's Against the Head, which, as usual and as ever, is on 2 at 8 o'clock. Till next week, thanks again for listening. Go easy.